praying to plot out what to talk with you about, that there is a way in which there's a certain logical sequence, but it doesn't work because there are things I want you to do along the way, and I need to tell you things first for you to be able to do them that I would ordinarily put last in a course. That may not make any sense to you. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But that is to say, I am sort of conscious of doing bits and pieces. For example, this morning I'd like to talk to you about introductions. Logically, an introduction is prepared last in your sequence of preparation. That is, there is no such thing as a good introduction. There is only a good introduction to a particular sermon. The verb to introduce, as you well know, is a transitive verb. That means it takes an object. So you're always introducing something. And until you know what you are going to introduce, you really cannot produce an introduction. So logically, at least, no matter how we do it, logically it comes after you have put the body of the message together and you know what you want to introduce. We have not really done that in our progress so far, but I think it's important to talk to you about introductions because I would like you to work on them before we get to your sermons. Introductions are important because they come first. And often the first and last activity that we have in some social engagements is very important. If you have a party and you have friends coming over, and you have people coming over who are not friends, you know that you ought to work on how the thing begins. We often have mixers, games that we play to get people to know each other. I have never read a mixer in a book that I thought would work. They all kind of sound goofy. You know, put the names of authors on people's back and have them guess what author they are, you know, that sort of thing. You've got to be out of your mind to do that. But it works. I mean, somehow it gets people together. So you think about that. If you have a good social evening, you also think about how it's going to end. We've all been party to engagements that sort of dribble out and die at the end. Or you have guests that come over and just don't know when to leave, and it goes on and on and on and on. And, you know, if you're wise, you put on the invitation, we'll be meeting, you know, for dinner from 7 to 9:30. At least you say it's after the close. But usually the beginning and the end of a social engagement is a very important part of whether or not it's going to work. Comedians know that how they open the act has a lot to do with whether they're going to get the audience to laugh. And they know also they've got to have a closer. They've got to have a final joke that sort of brings the whole thing together. Just beginning and end, very important. We also know out of persuasive studies that the law of primacy and the law of recency dominate what people remember. The law of primacy is what comes first gets people interest, and they will remember it. And what comes last, and what you're saying, has great impact, which says that the introduction and the conclusion of a sermon has greater impact and greater importance than other parts of the sermon, simply because it's what the audience hears first, what they hear last. If you are preaching to a congregation on a given Sunday morning, the introduction is important because there's a lot of evidence that people make up their mind in the first 30 seconds as to whether or not this is going to be interesting. They will make up their minds in the first 90 seconds as to whether they're going to listen to you or not. If they decide in the first 90 seconds, first minute and a half, that this really doesn't have much to do with them, or that this is going to be another boring session, they turn off the light. So if you're going to go after people, you go after them fast. I think that is heightened in our culture by the dominance of television. Television producers know that you have your hand on that switch. And so they know when they come on with that program that they don't now run the title of the program and who produced it and who directed it and who designed it and all that kind of stuff. And then finally, as the old movies used to do, get around to the movie. They start in before you ever see any credits by grabbing you and getting you to watch. Because they know that people will switch that dial, and the introduction has a lot to do with whether you're going to stay tuned. If it's true in television, it seems to me it becomes true in a culture. People want to know up front and fast whether this is going to introduce, this is going to interest them. So before I talk about introductions, let me lay on you just a little theory. So that the how we talk about introductions grows out of that theory. One of the things you want to do as you begin a talk is to get people's attention. Obviously, if you don't get attention, the game is over before it starts. The difficulty is that you can get attention by very quickly, but it doesn't last. If you're driving down a highway, your focus of your attention can change 200 times a minute. Attention is a very fleeting thing. So while it's important to get attention when you start, there is no way you can keep attention by focusing attention. In order to hold attention, what you have to do is to focus on what people are interested in. That is, what holds our attention, what holds our interest is what we give our attention to. If two people are making a trip across Australia, if one is a sociologist and the other is an archaeologist, they might cover essentially the same territory. But if you're unfortunate enough to have to go to watch their slides, they're going to be a very different set of slides. Sociologist is going to be focusing on people in groups. The archaeologist is going to be focused on rocks. Now, they will give their attention to what they're interested in. If you're interested in people interacting with each other, you will tend to take your pictures there. If you're interested in rock formations, then that's what the slideshow is going to be about. So interest is longer lasting, and we will give our attention to what interests us. But even more basic than interest is need. That is, we are most interested in those things that we feel we need. Need is basic. Need is dominant. Example, you may be a scholar of art. You may love to visit the museum and see great paintings. And you're very interested in that. But if as you are going through the museum looking at this marvelous art, you discover you need a restroom, it is amazing how the focus of your attention has changed utterly. I mean, you can walk past Rembrandt. you can walk past all kinds of display of art looking for just a room that says men or women. Because you need that. What you need is dominant, and it dominates you. So, as you look at how we work with introductions, what we are after is getting attention. But attention is based on interest. Interest is based on need. Putting it another way, when you get up to speak, people give you voluntary attention. Either that or they're a lynch mob. Some of your churches may seem close to that. But the way the game is played is that people give you attention. I have been in some churches where I am not sure that that's what the congregation understands about the game. I've been in congregations where when you get up to preach, it's as though everything unplugs. I think that's often true of congregations where the sermons, Sunday after Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, have been as boring as an income tax form. And here you get up and people just unplug. But generally, they give you attention for a minute and a half. What you're trying to do is take voluntary attention and turn it into involuntary attention. That is, people are now no longer listening because they have to listen. They're listening because they want to listen. They give you attention, but you have to quickly grab the attention. They're listening because they want to listen. So, that's basically the theory that we're working with. The tension is fleeting. Interest is a bit more fixed. But need is absolutely basic. Therefore, when we design an introduction to a sermon, the first thing that you want to do when you get up to speak is to get the audience's attention. This means that the first 25 words or so is are among the most important words in the sermon. They may not necessarily be clear, but they do have to be interesting. I have a kind of hobby. I'm in a bookstore. I will work through a section of books, simply taking them down and looking at the first paragraph. If you've ever done any writing, you know that you sit there with a pad of paper in front of you, and you've got to begin. Halfway through the first chapter, you may be in high gear, but you just sit there saying, how do I begin? Always intriguing to read the opening words of a novel. They're the beginning of an experience. And so I'm intrigued to see how the novelist begins. The opening words, therefore, need to get attention. Let me tell you what won't make it. Last week we were in Genesis 31. This week we're in Genesis 32. And you can, you know, kind of bet that next week we'll be in Genesis 33. You discover is that the preacher somehow thinks that people got up in the morning thinking, man, do we want to hear about Genesis 31. That doesn't get attention. It doesn't get you off to a good start. But you might begin a sermon by saying, this morning I'd like to tell you about the most courageous person I ever knew. That's the promise of a story. Or you might begin by saying, if the statistics that I have read about Australia are true, in the course of a marriage, 60% of Australian men will be unfaithful to their wives. And I suspect that some of you here have contributed to that statistic. Or this morning I'd like to talk to you about money. I'd like to talk to you about your money. I'd like to ask you a simple question. Do you worship it? All I'm saying is you start with a sentence, the first 25 words, and they set the tone for what follows. Do you love God? Let me ask you a more basic question. Do you like Him? Whatever else you do at the beginning, you're getting folks immediately set to say, well, you know, it might be interesting. They're making up their emotions as to whether or not they're going to listen. First words are crucial in a sermon. Having gotten attention, however, you know you can't sustain that. Just simply trying to find a group of clever sentences for the rest of the sermon just won't do it. So the second thing you are trying to do in a good introduction is to surface need. We give our attention to what we need. There is a law in communication that is called Cohen's Law. It's very cleverly named because it is the result of Arthur Cohen's research. And the law is simply this. Information that is given in response to a perceived need makes a deeper impact and lasts longer, is retained longer than information that's given and then applied. That is so important that I'd like to say it again. Information given in response to a perceived need makes a deeper impact and is retained longer than information that's given and then applied. In other words, if you know you need this information, then you're going to listen to it. Imagine that you are taking a trip through Japan, and you are in one of those small villages 30 miles or so south of Tokyo. If you're on a tour bus, the person conducting the tour might say to you, this little town has been here, as far as we can tell, well over 1,000 years. As you enter, you will find what you would call a bakery. People in that bakery have been preparing delicacies for the emperor. Whenever he has a special party, it is this little bakery that supplies the delicacies. Across the way, one street down, you will find a costume shop. Intriguing place. Has a series of costumes that dignitaries of Japan have worn for 500 or 600 years. It almost shows you the evolution of the culture. In the center of the town, there was a large monument. It was erected after what you would call World War II for the people in this town who died fighting for the Japanese armies. A great many of the men were killed. On the other side of the square, you might be interested in a luggage shop. It obviously sells luggage, but it has been in existence for almost 400 years. It's intriguing what people have called luggage over the years. Beyond that, you'll find a cemetery. So it's odd, since many people in Japan now are cremated, but this is an old cemetery. And you might, as you walk along among the stones, realize that some of those stones are almost 1,000 years old. Go beyond the cemetery, you'll find a gate that takes you out of the town, and our bus will be there in about 45 minutes. We'll meet you. Now you get out of the bus. Say to your wife, what did he say? They sold the cakes. I'd like a cup of coffee, a cup of tea. But imagine instead that you're not on a tour bus. Imagine that it's World War II. You're part of the Australian forces, and you have been dropped behind enemy lines in Japan on a secret mission. You're outside that town, but you're crouched next to a man who is part of the Allied forces. He's in the Secret Service. He is there as a spy. And he says to you, as you're crouched outside that town, I want you to listen to me. I can only tell you this once, but your life may depend upon it. When you go into the town, over to the left, you'll find a costume shop. Be careful. Those people are fanatical supporters of Japan. On the other side, you'll find a cake shop. Those people we know are sympathizers. We don't want to risk them, but if you should get into trouble, they might help you. Center of town is a large monument, casts a shadow, and it's possible you could find a place there to hide if you had to. Beyond that, there's a place that sells luggage. We know those people. They are with us. If you needed help, somebody there speaks English. I think they could be of real help to you. Beyond that, there's a cemetery. People don't go into the cemetery. It's just kind of a sacred place. So if you were there, you might be able to protect yourself. At any rate, I have to leave you. You'll be in there for an hour. You've got to make out the best you can. But an hour from now, somebody will meet you on the other side of town and take you to freedom. Goodbye. I bet you. You will remember everything that man said. Because information that's given in response to a perceived need makes a deeper impact and lasts longer than information that's given and then applied. So what you want to do in your introduction is to surface need. In traditional homiletics, if you say to people, where do you apply the sermon? Answer is usually, well, you know, at the end. You preach the sermon, at the end you apply it. I am arguing that the application starts in the introduction. Early on, you surface a question, you raise a problem, you create a need. Let me illustrate. You may start a sermon by saying, several years ago, a young graduate of a seminary in the United States, Neil Chambers, had a burden for the people in Ecuador. He was going down to Quito, Ecuador, to serve in the radio station, HCJB. In order to get there, he had to fly from New York to Miami, and then from Miami on to Quito, Ecuador. He was in the Miami airport, wanted to write a note to his parents before he left the United States. And he found a large sheet of newspaper and an ad that had a lot of white space. He scrawled a note and then folded it, put it in an envelope, mailed it to his parents, got on the plane, and headed for Latin America. On the way to Quito, the plane slammed against a mountain. Everybody on the plane, pilot and passengers, was killed. 2 days after Mr. Chambers' parents learned of his death, they received the envelope that he had mailed in the airport. They read the scrawled note, but it was written around an advertisement that had as a major question, W-H-Y. Why? Anyone who has faced life head on and tried to make it square with faith looks at things that happen in their lives that seem inconsistent with what you think about God when you ask why. Why would a young man who is just preparing to serve Jesus Christ, who has a deep devotion to his cause and is desperately needed, why would he be killed before he got the chance to even put the plow into the ground? Why? What you have done is to surface a need so that in a good introduction, you not only get attention with your opening sentence, but your opening paragraph or paragraphs creates a need. Several months ago, I was talking with a vice president of a large secular publishing house in New York City. It was his task to read manuscripts and decide which manuscripts the firm would accept, what they would reject. I asked him how many manuscripts he read in the, or evaluated in the course of a year, and he said, probably 500. And I said to him, I read rather rapidly, but there's no way you can read 500 manuscripts in a year. He said, well, you're right. He said, in fact, I don't read them all. He said, what I do is I read the first three or four pages. I want to see how this author comes on to his readers. What I discovered, he said, we're wrong occasionally, but what I discovered is that if this man hasn't gotten the reader's attention in the first four pages, he will not get it later on. And then I know I'm dealing with a boring book. And one thing we're not into is publishing boredom. What he was saying about books is said about sermons. Early on, you get attention and you surface need. Information given in response to a perceived need makes a deeper impact and is retained longer than information that is given and simply applied. The third thing you do in a good introduction is not only get attention, not only surface need, but the third thing that you do is that you orient the audience to your sermon. That is, you are now going to build a bridge from your introduction into what you have to say. When you orient the audience, that is, to show them how this relates to the body of the sermon, you can orient them to several things. One is, you can orient them, if it's a deductive sermon, to the idea of the message. Or you can orient them to the first point in the message. If you orient them to the idea, that is, you state the idea, then you must immediately raise a question about that idea. What does it mean? Is that really true? What difference does it make? Some form of that. Because if you were to come through an introduction and state the idea, and the idea is the answer to your need, the sermon's over. There's no tension. Many times, as I evaluate introductions, and I think I have said this to you before, but it's worth repeating, I think most of you are well aware that you have to get attention. You're not quite as aware of the need to establish need. So often what you will get in an introduction is a story that doesn't raise questions but answers questions. Doesn't open up a problem, it answers the problem. So that often we put into the introduction an illustration that should be in the conclusion. Therefore, as I listen to the introduction, there's a good story. The story gets my attention. Case in point. Back during the early part of the 1800s, before our American Civil War, where there was slavery in the South and the free states were up in the northern part of our country, there was a young Presbyterian minister by the name of William Armstrong. William Armstrong was curious about slavery, and so one summer during his vacation, he sailed down our Mississippi River to the city of New Orleans. And while he was in New Orleans, he decided that he would attend a slave auction. Never seen slavery before. And he stood there and he watched as husbands were separated from their wives and children were taken from their parents and sold to the highest bidder. And then as he sat there, almost overwhelmed by what he was seeing, a young woman was led in to the auction. She was a mulatto. She had dark and white pigment in her skin. She was a woman of great beauty. As William Armstrong stood there, he listened to the men around him as she was led up to the auction block. And they told what they would do if they got hold of her body. One of the men who sailed the Mississippi River on one of the steamers said, if I get that girl, I can make a fortune from her. Another man said, he'd make a very pretty slave in my house. The bidding began. Someone offered $500. The captain offered $700. Another man offered $1,000. The captain offered $1,200. And William Armstrong said, I'll give you $1,500. Captain snarled and said, boy, if you want her that bad, you can have her. William Armstrong went forward and paid out $1,500, which was a large amount of money. And took the girl as a slave. They got outside. She said to him, Mister, I don't know who you are. If I ever get the chance, I'll kill you. I said, well, you don't understand. He said, I come from up north in the state of Ohio. We have no use for slaves. So I just stood there, and I was overwhelmed by what those men would do. I couldn't allow it to happen. Here are your papers. You're a free woman. I have no use for a slave. He turned and he began to walk away, and the woman stood there. She wasn't able to read, but she knew those papers meant that she would never be a slave again. And then as Armstrong was disappearing into the darkness, she raced after him and grabbed him around the waist and then threw her arms around her legs as she around his legs as she fell to her knees. And she said, you be my master. I'll serve you the rest of my life. Well, that's a great conclusion. Terrible introduction. Because if you were to conclude that, if you were coming to a conclusion, you might say, and there was a time in my life when I was a slave. And Jesus Christ came and with a nail-pierced hand paid the price for my freedom. And he really set me free. No strings attached. In the light of love like that, what else could I do but to say, you be my master. I'll serve you the rest of my life. If you came out of the introduction, however, and you told that story, and you said what William Armstrong did with that slave is what the Apostle Paul says in Romans 6, Jesus Christ did for us. I'd like you to turn to Romans 6 and see that. There's no tension. I mean, the sermon's all over. Not only is it an emotional story, which is a bad place to begin, but I know exactly what you're going to tell me. You've gotten my attention, and in a sense, you have created need with that story, but once you give me the punchline, the need is met. You're going to tell me that Jesus Christ did for me what William Armstrong did for the girl, and therefore I ought to be loyal to Jesus Christ. I got the whole thing figured out. There's no need there. There's a tension, no need. So many times you get stories in the introduction that ought to be in the conclusion. The introduction opens up questions. It doesn't close them. It opens up problems. It doesn't solve them. The question is, could you perhaps tell part of the story at the beginning and complete it at the end? Sometimes you can do that, provided that the part you tell creates a need. Yeah, that is, one of the most effective ways to encapsulate a sermon is to tell a story at the beginning that sounds as though it's the whole story. It raises the question. For example, this isn't true, but in the story I told you about Chambers being killed, okay, if I had if I could have made it need oriented enough to say that, to tell the story as I did, if I came back at the end to say as a result of what happened in Chambers' life and in his death, at least 300 young people, hearing what had occurred, gave their lives to take his place. So that by his death, God raised up a core of people to touch the folks at Ecuador. That were true. I could do that. To do that at the end would be a way of putting the sermon together at the beginning and at the end. And that is a very effective thing to do. Only just one warning. It's got to be true. but you could do that. That is a way of doing it. So the point is that what you're really trying to do is to create need, and then as you orient, if you orient to the idea, if you state what the idea is, then you must raise a question about the idea. Having stated it, then I have to say, well, okay, but what's that mean? Or is that really true? Well, you know, what difference does it make? If I don't have any more questions, the sermon is over, even though I'm going to talk for another 30 minutes. Or I can orient to the first point. That would be true if I were dealing with a subject completed. Remember, when we talk about a subject, we're talking about the complete, well-defined answer to the question, what am I talking about? Okay. One form a sermon takes is a subject introduced in the introduction, completed in the sermon. If you know Kohler's approach to homiletics, elaborated by Perry and Witzel, those names may mean nothing to you, they may mean something to you. They have what they call the key word approach. So as you come out of your introduction, you have a key word. There are four people who, and your sermon deals with four people. There are three reasons why, so your sermon deals with reasons. There are four steps to holiness, and so your sermon deals with steps, okay? The subject completed is one way of developing a sermon. So if you do that, you would, in your introduction, you'd raise a need about how can we live a holy life? How is it possible? And you might say, the Bible says that there are four issues we must face if we are really sincere about being the people God wants us to be. The first issue, and that's your first point, is we've got to decide who runs our lives. So you orient to the first point in a subject completed. And the second point is the next issue, and third, so on and so forth. You also orient to the first point when you develop a sermon inductively. Sermons, speaking generally, have a deductive arrangement or they can have an inductive arrangement. When you think of traditional homiletics, the way it's been taught for centuries, it is a deductive arrangement. In a deductive arrangement, the idea is stated up front, and then it's developed. The idea is explained, it's proved, it's applied, but however you deal with it, it's stated up front. For 2,000 years, that has been the major way sermons have been developed. It comes out of Greco-Roman rhetoric, the teaching about rhetoric from Greece and Rome. It's the way most sermons develop. But it is also possible to develop a sermon inductively. What you do inductively is you do not state your idea until the end of the message. The sermon that Peter preaches at Pentecost is an inductive message. The idea is stated in verse 37 at the end of the message. God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified. You often use an inductive message when you're dealing with an antagonistic audience. And Peter was dealing with an audience that would have killed him if he had stated that idea up front. He had said, you know, today I'd like to talk to you about Jesus Christ. And what I want to say to you about him are two things. God has made him both Lord and Christ, even though you crucified him. I mean, that's the end of his sermon. Plenty of tension. But he would never have gotten to make his second point. I mean, never gotten to make his first point. So if you look at the way he develops that sermon, he starts by talking about the phenomena that they had seen. And they explain the speaking in tongues as though, you know, they were drunk. That's what they say. The guy just, you know, hung one eye. And Peter, I think in a very humorous way, stands up and says, look, yeah, this isn't drunk. I mean, it's only 9 in the morning, and we don't, the tavern's not even open yet. I don't think it was a serious explanation of what was occurring. He was picking up where they were at. And then he says, this is what was in the book of Joel. First part of Joel is that there comes a day when young men will dream dreams and the young woman will be turned on to God. I mean, you know the quote. And at the end of that quote, it says, and after this occurs, the moon will turn to blood, there will be all kinds of judgment. Following an outpouring, there is judgment. And the quote ends in Joel, whoever calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved. And the question you raise, who's the Lord? Peter then talks about Jesus. He has to answer a question up front and fast. How in the world could somebody who was hung on a Roman execution rack be the Messiah of God? We all know the Old Testament says a person who dies hanging on a tree or hanging from a tree is cursed. So he starts in by saying, you know the deeds he did. That shows he was a good man. Because they were good deeds, they were miracles. So if a good man dies on a cross, he can't be a bad man. It must mean that God has a purpose for this. And he does. And not only did he die, this good man, under God's plan and purpose, but God raised him from the dead. And he quotes the Old Testament, quotes David. He calls David a patriarch. He calls him a prophet. That was their authority. It was their book. That was their man. And he reasons from the Psalm 16, that what sounded like it applied to David, that you will not leave my soul in the grave, or let your Holy One see corrupt, couldn't have referred to David. Because down the street, there's David's tomb. He did see corrupt, so it applies to Jesus. And it applies to Jesus because we're witnesses of what occurred. And the next thing he develops is that God raised him from the dead and he sits on God's right hand, according to Psalm 116, waiting until his enemies would be made his footstool. He's declared to be Lord. For the Lord said, David says, my Lord said, the Lord said to my Lord, sit on my right hand till your enemies become your footstool. So, it couldn't refer to David, referred to Christ. This outpouring has come because that's where he is, and he's got his feet on the footstool of his enemies. Which, if you go to the Near East, down in Egypt, you will find the footstools of the pharaohs, and on those footstools are carved the enemies of the pharaoh. Every time he put his feet down, it was on his enemies. A vivid picture. So you ask, who qualifies best to be an enemy? It's the people who hung up and murdered Jesus that he referred to earlier on. And so his punchline is, God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified. And they said, what in the world are we going to do? I mean, they had killed the one who was the Lord. They had murdered the one who could save them from judgment. I mean, this isn't, you know, kind of a mystical thing. The Spirit of God fell down upon them and they were all very much moved because God moved. They were in a mess. Psychologically, he has demonstrated that they killed the Messiah, they murdered the Lord, and the only one who could save him from judgment was the Lord. That's why they kept saying, what will we do? Okay. That sermon is developed inductively. He doesn't give the idea until he comes to the end. People in persuasion call it the yes-yes approach. he quoted from Joel. That was their prophet. Can't argue with that. It's your authority. He quotes from David, and he makes it a point of calling David a patriarch and a prophet, quoting their scriptures and quoting one of their top men. He quotes Psalm 116 back to them. Goes back to their experience. You can go down. You could see David's too. And you have to say, yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right. That's right. Oh. If you agree to this, you got this. That's induction. One of the reasons that induction is such an effective way of preaching is that that's how we learn in life. That is, we learn by induction, not by deduction. You have this experience, you meet this person, you have this happen to you. You have all of these different experiences, and then from all of that, you kind of induce a principle. It's street smarts. You've been around long enough, played the game hard enough, you make inductions. The best soccer players, the best cricket players, who've been around a long time, say, well, he's experienced. What you really mean is not that he's necessarily a stronger athlete now. He may have been a lot stronger as a young buck starting out, but you give him 8 years' experience, and he has induced things about that game. Okay. So induction is the way we learn about life. It has about it the element of surprise, has the element of unfolding. So if I'm going to do an inductive sermon, what I have to do is to orient people to the first point. If people don't listen this way, you understand, but if they were homileticians, they would believe when I introduced them to the first point, that's the whole sermon. You follow me? That is, again, people just hear sermon. They don't hear it in points and all this. But it would sound as though I was doing in an inductive message what I was doing here. That is, I introduce the first point. And I go through the first point, and people, if they were thinking, say, well, okay, that's what his sermon is. But when I come to the second point in an inductive message, my transition comes out of the first point, and it raises questions that demand more explanation. For example, suppose in my first point, I have made the point from the psalm that God always deals in kindness with his people. And I developed that. The psalmist talks about God's loving kindness. He points to the incidents in the life of Israel to show that God has been gracious and good to the people. I developed that. So it sounds like the sermon is going to be about God's good, God's kind, God's wonderful. Okay? But I come at the end of that point and I say, it sounds good, doesn't it? Except that if you're a thinking person, you got questions. One question is, God is kind sometimes. Or God may seem kind to some people. But how do you explain the fact that even in the life of Israel, they were in slavery for 100 years? That explains the fact that, as the psalmist has questioned, they went to battle in holy war, believing they were on God's side, believing they were doing God's will, and they were wiped out. How do you make that fit with the kindness of God? And so the psalmist says something else. He's saying that the kindness of God must also be linked with the purposes of God. Now you question, what's that mean? And that's what that point's about. Okay. When I come to the end of my second point and I hit my third point, if there is a third point, again I have a transition that builds the bridge to the third point. That is, another question must emerge. Another question has to emerge that leads me to the third point. Only so that there's always the unfolding. If I do it well, my third point often ends up being also my conclusion. And it's down here that I state my idea. This is what brings it all together. So when I am doing an inductive message, out of my introduction, I have to relate people to the first point. And then, having developed the first point, I raise questions that lead to the second. And then I raise questions that lead to the third. Putting it another way, in an inductive message, each of these major transitions is like another introduction. I have to surface need again. Now, as effective as inductive preaching is, it is very difficult. Let me tell you why it's difficult. Everything depends on your establishing those transitions. In a deductive message, if I am out grazing someplace and I haven't followed you, I can go back to the idea that you've established, or the subject that you've laid down. I always have an orienting point. Oh, yeah, I remember that's what he's talking about. There's four ways to be holy. I think this is the third one. I've got an orienting point. If you give me the idea, I've got that to go back to. But in this, I don't have an orienting point. I don't have a subject. I don't have an idea. I have the first point. But if someplace in here I get lost, I don't know where I am. You don't build this bridge to this point, it's all over. Teaching at the seminary, we, as you would imagine, deal with induction. I say just what I said to you to class, usually the class of folks haven't preached much. And invariably, somebody says, well, that's my stuff. Well, if that's interesting and that's unfolding, that's how I'm going to preach. And so, you know, it's fine. A student gets up and tries it. And you cannot imagine how much foggy bottom there is in a thing like that. You sit there and you think, where in the world? I mean, I'm a professional listener. I probably listened to 8,000 sermons in my life. You know, and analyze. I don't know where he is. I don't know what he's doing. I think he must be into induction or something, but I don't know what the induction. I don't know where he is. If you analyze your own preaching in doing deductive preaching, as I analyze mine, I listen to sermons 6 weeks, 2 months later, they're cold. They're somebody else's sermon. I can listen to my own sermon and say, "Boy, that's a real blessing. That's, boy, that's good stuff." Or, what in the world was I doing? As much as I know the need for transitions, I find in deduction that often, in terms of the form of the sermon, I blow the transition. And the reason is, it's clear to me. I mean, I know what I'm talking about. It's very clear to me. So it's clear to me, it's clear to you. That is the fatal mistake of a communicator. I mean, the one thing you depend upon is that you haven't communicated and they haven't gotten it. And that's the basic rule. So you need to take time to bring people with you. You know, that's deduction. That's the easiest thing to follow. You get the induction, and if you don't take the time to cross the bridge and help them to cross it with you. And that takes, we're talking in a transition of this sort, something often in the neighborhood of 6-7 sentences. We're talking maybe about a key illustration that raises the question. We're talking about a hunk of material. You can't make this transition in 2 or 3 sentences. Seldom can you make it in 2 or 3 sentences, because you have to show them where you've been, you have to show them where you're going, you have to raise the question in order to establish the connection. And the amateur does not do transitions well. The professional doesn't do very well. But so that's where you get lost in. You have a question. I mean, over the sermon over a period of time?
To be constantly inductive.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it over Sunday after Sunday.
Yeah,
it's a very difficult form to use.
And yet they raise the issue that this is the method that Jesus used with the parables.
Sure. But you see, if you tell stories, you're home free. Stories, by their nature, are inductive. You tell a joke, the punchline's at the end. I mean, you've all been around people who give you the miserable punch. Oh, did you hear about the chicken that crossed the road and didn't get to the other side? I don't know if I have. Well, it said that there was a chicken. They go through this whole thing. You already heard the punchline. I mean, talk about terrible stuff. Good joke tellers know where the punchline comes. Good storytellers know you got to have a punchline, unless you're Irish. The Irish love to tell stories. They don't know where they're going with them. But stories work. But when we're talking about the kind of thing you get in Acts 2, or you're talking about it more abstraction, then it becomes extremely difficult. I don't think that's a very good book, a very challenging book. I don't think it's a very good book. I don't think they've really come to grips with the nature of induction and even why it works and how you put it together. The more concrete your sermon is, more towards the story, the easier it is to carry induction. People can go to a movie and sit for an hour and a half in a detective movie and wait until the end to find out who did it. That works. People don't sit around listening to an abstract lecture on criminology and wait until the end. I mean, you've got to be superb. So you're right. I mean, if you found that to be true, then I think you understand a bit about induction. Because more people think they can just go out and pull this thing off, and you can't. It's tough work. It's great preaching. If you do it well, you unfold and people follow you. But Sometimes you look around and you're the only one out there. The sheep decide they go home.
Marry the two, but deliberately, is there a case for marrying the two?
Yes. As I look, I mean, sometimes you think, you do start out by saying, I ought to do this inductively. Remember what I said yesterday. If you know where you want to go, know where you want to start, and then you say, how do I get there? As I look at sermons of mine, I find that I will often work inductively up to the second point, sometimes the third point. And that's where I, if you ask, where do I state my idea for the first time? I did that yesterday. I have, you know, in terms of, after I got to talking about Joe, I stated what I was about when I was talking about he was a man of faith. And after that, once you state your idea, everything has to be deductive. Once that's given, then you have to explore the implications of it. So I find that I do that. I'll work out of my introduction into my first point. The first point might lead to the second point, and that second point is where I really state the idea, and then come out of it. So I do combine the two.
So a topical sermon would then be perhaps more related to this particular method.
Yeah, I guess. Although. Maybe if you take your question at face value, more so, I'd say perhaps. But you can do it with exposition of a passage. It depends where you start with the passage. If you have a cause and effect in a passage, you might start with the effects, and then raise the question about cause, that kind of thing. It has, I think, a lot more to do with the material. Stories, narrative is easier. Has to do with an audience. If you're dealing with an antagonistic audience, you're more likely to do this. If you're dealing with evangelism, you're more likely to do this. If you're dealing with an audience where you with a significant number of people and not Christians, you got to ask where are they, and how do I take where they are? What are their felt needs? I have to show them what their felt needs are related to something deeper than their felt need. Then I have to go back and say, how does the Bible deal with this? I mean, so there's a whole inductive development.
I've often heard preachers start off. Let's imagine we're on a time machine. We're traveling back in time. How hard is it to, when you've got congregation participation like that, to hold right through on your sermon?
Well, if you can get them to get on the time machine with you, it's all right. Most of the time, many times, the audience says, I've been there before, I've heard that before. All he wants to do is get back into the Bible fast. You know, it's kind of a cheap trick. If seldom does that create need. Now, hear me well. Curiosity can be a good need. The only problem with curiosity is it won't take you home. It won't deliver the goods. That you may start with curiosity, but you've got to move to a deeper need in order for people to respond to what you're saying. Curiosity gets attention, and you can work with that for quite a while in a sermon. But having satisfied your curiosity isn't going to change your life. It's there. It's like an itch. It's good to scratch it, but it isn't going to really do anything to your bloodstream. So many times a sermon starts, that's the only need I can think of. There's things I can raise that would touch curiosity. But I know before I'm through, I've got to get into something deeper than that. If I don't, that it won't change life. People only change when, and they don't do that very often, when they sense a deep need and some way to change. And what you have, by the way, and just this is a footnote, very seldom do people change as a result of one sermon. Now and then in a sermon people will change, but it's almost always because they've had two things going for them. One is pain, and the second is time. Time plus pain produces change. If you're completely happy, you don't have any pain, any frustration, why change? But if there's pain and there's time, after a while people say, you know, I've had this depression long enough, I've had this sense of emptiness long enough, or it's pain plus time that does it. Your sermon may come along at a time when they say, I'm tired of this, you know, and you get a response, but it isn't because, well, maybe your sermon is filled with a lot of time, a lot of pain, but bad preaching doesn't make the change, believe it. Okay, so what I'm trying to do here is to say that's what you're doing in the introduction of an inductive message. Okay? Now let me just say one more set of things. Good introduction gets attention. Good introduction surfaces need and it orients what follows. These three things, as far as I'm concerned, are not debatable. You can argue them all you want, but I am sure I have read the introductions to 2,000 sermons. I mean, one of the ways you find out what is a good introduction is read them and look at the ones that grab you. So I read introductions to find out what they're about. This is not negotiable. Get attention, surface a need, orient. So that when you come out of that introduction, there are large questions. Okay? That's John 3:16. It was crucial. But let me suggest some other things that I think are desirable, but you can fudge on it. You know, this I think is basic form. You cannot deny this and get away with it. You end up being boring. But let me tell you some other things that I think usually characterize good introductions, but not always, okay? So this is not negotiable as far as I'm concerned. These are negotiable to an extent. One thing about a good introduction is contemporary. By that I mean effective introductions start in the 20th century and not in the first century. Remember I said yesterday that the philosophy of communication is that I'm talking to the people in the pew about them from the Bible. I'm not talking to the people in the pew about the Bible. So the subject and object of my preaching, in a sense, is the people in the pew. And they live in the 20th century. Therefore, I want my sermon to start in the 20th century. It ought to be contemporary. But not only should it be contemporary, but it also ought to be personal. You may start off talking about abortion. That's contemporary. You might start off for some reason to say it's estimated that in the societies of the Western world one woman out of 10 has had an abortion. In some societies, in a given year, half of the babies conceived were killed before they were born. There's no doubt that abortion is, in our cultures, a major form of birth control. And all of us are faced with it. That's contemporary. But someplace in that introduction, you've got to make it personal. To talk about abortions as a kind of abstract problem in Australian or American society isn't enough. So you might say, well, not just the problem for the people out there, it's a problem for the people here. Suspect that in this audience there are some of you who have had an abortion. You may feel guilty about it now, but the reality is you have. Some of you are wrestling with whether or not that is a solution to a pregnancy that you had not planned. Some of you may have a daughter who has told you that she's pregnant. And you feel the fear deep inside of you, what that means to her, to her life, to her future. And even though you were against abortion several months ago, it has touched your life. It seems like for you, in this situation, it's a solution. So I'm not talking about some abstract problem that affects the society. Talking about our problem. Wonder if God has anything to say about it that could be helpful. Okay. You've moved personally. You can start off a sermon by saying, marriages are under all kinds of threat in our society. Marriage out of every two ends up in divorce. And if marriage and family is the foundation of a society, then it seems like our society is crumbling. If it's the backbone of a country, then we're suffering from a curvature of the spine. It is a problem in Australian culture. But someplace in there, you've got to come down and say, and while it's out there, it's real to us, isn't it? It's as real as the fact that you and your wife have had an argument several weeks ago. You've not gotten it settled. And there's a coldness between you. Almost like an iceberg. This is real for some of you here today who have contemplated leaving the responsibility of a family. Your marriage is not what it was promised to be. It is not as happy as you thought it should be. You feel that it's not fulfilling and you'd like to leave your husband. Take off on your own. You feel like you're trapped in a bad marriage. This is real as folks in this congregation who've been divorced. And you feel the hurt of it. And sometimes you wonder what God has to say to you about it. You know, all I'm saying is you've got to bring it in and make it personal. Abstract problems are out there and people listen to them as abstractions. But the question is, does it touch the person in the seventh row, four seats in from the end? Touch anybody here, and how? And so it's got to be personal. The third thing that usually happens in an introduction is it has to be biblical, or it's biblical, and I mean by biblical someplace in this sermon, you've got to get into the Bible. Don't always get it in the introduction, but it's often there. In our cultures that are increasingly secular, however, there's a kind of great leap we make into the Bible that I think is unwarranted. That is, going through something about marriage and making it personal. The leap goes something like this. After you say, you know, you're hurting and it's real to you, then you say, over in the book of Ephesians, Paul speaks about this. Turn with me in the Bible to the book of Ephesians. That's the jump. I would argue that in a secular society like ours, you're making a lot of assumptions, even among people who are Christians. Namely, of course, we turn to the Bible. I think you have to lay down a groundwork of demonstrating to people that the Bible is a pretty likely source. You might say, for example, it's interesting that God is concerned about your family. In fact, God's desperately concerned about families. He was the one who gave the first bride away. He was the one who performed the first marriage ceremony. Marriage isn't the invention of sociologists. It comes to us from the hand of God. Before there was a church, before there were nations, there was a family. And God established it. That's why as you read through the Bible, you discover that God has a lot to say about families. Deeply concerned about them. Because they were his invention. You have a family because God ordained it. And that's why when you turn to the New Testament, you discover there's a lot about a family. Especially about how husbands and wives are to relate. Paul wrote to a church over in what we think of as Turkey, a city called Ephesus. He talked to them about a lot of things. But one of the things he did was to talk to them about their families. Paul knew how important their families were to them. He also knew how important family was to God. If you'd like to see the advice that he gave to those people, you can find it in a letter that he wrote. Okay, thank you, sir. What you have done is built a bridge into the Bible. I think you have to have the attitude that a thing is not true because it's in the Bible. It's in the Bible because it's true. I believe it's in the Bible, and it's in the Bible, it's true. I live in a society in which that's wishful thinking. So I have to say, all right, if this is true, this is how God set this up, can I demonstrate its truth? So I cannot assume, as we always do, the Bible has an answer to all of our questions. That's absolutely baloney. What kinds of questions you have the Bible doesn't speak to? How do you lose weight? I know passages on dieting. A lot of things that people could all... I mean, now, there may be in this desire to lose weight principles that this may be a symptom of something deeper in our lives that we have to look at. I mean, it's something else. But there's all kinds of questions people have the Bible doesn't speak to. But there are some questions the Bible does speak to. And they are the gut-level, wrenching questions of life. And so I need to be constantly saying to folks, when you really get to the bottom questions, the tough questions, the Bible speaks to it. And it speaks to it to the lives of men and women who face the questions just like you did. There's a lot of difference between the people that lived in the first century and people that live in the 20th century, but there's a lot of things the same. You kick them and their leg turned blue. You hurt them, and they would weep. You made them angry, and they would fight back. In a lot of ways, of course, they're just like us. You've got to build that bridge. In a contemporary, in a society that is secular. The final thing, and it's the same thing I was saying before, you have to, you orient to what follows. That, again, is not debatable because you're introducing it, but these three are negotiable. I have read sermons that I think are pretty good sermons that started in the Bible. But they had about them a ring of the contemporary. I've read sermons, but didn't have the element of the personal, but they did well. I've read sermons that just jumped into the Bible like the deep end of the pool, and they got away with it. These, I think, are negotiable. The other three need, attention, need, orientation, or not. And that's what I have. The question is, if you have a third-person narrative where you're telling a story, you do not, in that sense, you're not contemporary, as you may be telling a story of another time, another place, and you're not necessarily personal. You do create a need because a story creates a need. Just as soon as I say, let me tell you about Henry Smith. I use that name because it happened to be his real name. But he was really an unreal kind of person. Or if you start out by saying, you meet the most unusual people when you're flying across the continent. That happened to me recently. You know, I never found out the man's name. You created a need. It's curiosity. Who is it? What is it? I mean, you've got to someplace get deeper than that, but stories create needs, yes.
I'm thinking more of the person who, preaching, you may take on the character of Nebuchadnezzar.
Oh, yeah. You, in that first person, you mean.
Narrative.
Well, yeah. And there, starting, you know, there it's the, there the if Nebuchadnezzar is doing his job, he often has the contemporary flavor about what he is doing. So that he is talking to an audience of people in the 20th century, and there are you can hardly develop that without in some way putting hooks into the audience that is, we have things in common. And you're doing it, it's doing it indirectly. But narrative often doesn't start out in the contemporary world, and it may not be personal. And I had that kind of thing in mind. And there are other sermons. I have one of the classic sermons is Clarence McCartney's sermon, Come Before Winter. And it's based on 2 Timothy chapter 4, where Paul writes to Timothy, says, come before winter. And but that sermon goes back and starts with Paul in a dungeon and what it was like, and he describes it, and he's writing to a young man, and Timothy wants him to come back, and he asks him for the cloaks, and he asks him for the parchment, but most of all he wants him for himself. And there is a relevance to it. You identify with Paul and you identify with his loneliness, but it's not what we're talking about here. All right. Yes, Margaret.
Alive, picking up illustrations from around all the jolly time.
Yes, illustrations are not negotiable. You don't necessarily have to tell a lot of stories, but if you are if you're contemporary and you're personal and you're vivid and you're concrete, people get the impression you've told a lot of stories.
You've got to be aware of picking up who we are.
Oh yeah, like an author, you try to develop an ear for it. If you listen to a conversation that you were doing very well the other day when you were talking about this culture, but if you're going to deal with the culture and talk about it, then you have to ask yourself, how does that show up? Reading ads in magazines is a great help. They spend millions of dollars trying to get people to get the punchline, and so if you can take the punchline and turn it, you get advantage of the free advertising. But you're trying, you're always struggling to stay in the 20th century if you're doing expository preaching. So the tendency is to take you back. Yes? Okay, Neil.
This area of personal, some of the things that you said there this morning have been tremendous in the way of illustration. But if we were to use them, if I were to use them in a small congregation, I'd probably be shot out of the congregation because they were too personal.
Okay. And you have to... It would be nice, though, if... Yeah, I agree. You know the congregation, and sometimes you know them too well. On the other hand, though... I was using it, and I was trying to find, common ground. But on the other hand, there are other problems that are things you would deal with, in which the fact that you do know the congregation, you're not putting them down. If you were dealing, for instance, if you were dealing with abortion, I think one of our problems is abortion. When we're talking about that issue, is we all end up being prophets. We thunder against abortion in our society. You don't dare treat that in our day without also being pastoral. Because what about that woman in your congregation who's had an abortion, has tried to cover it up? Every time she hears about this, she feels she's a murderess. What does God have to say to her? If you don't deal with that, then you end up just driving that kind of person into the ground. So there's always... it's interesting in Hebrews chapter 5... that the priest, the high priest, was taken from among men and women to represent people to God. I would have thought that the task of the priest was to represent God to the people. The writer of Hebrews said, no, he represents the people to God. And then he says, he not only makes sacrifice for their sins, but for his own sins. You can see why that's important, isn't it? I mean, it must have been pretty dreary business to be in the temple and always offering sacrifice. Imagine all just the people in your kind. Every time they come, they got sin. Pretty soon, you could be saying to yourself, what a wretched lot this is. Some of these people spending more money sacrificing and raising their kids. I mean, it's terrible. It'd be easy to get down on the people. Except that you have to